Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to this week's Classic Replay. It's Justin here to introduce today's show from the archive. Now, this was a really memorable one, recorded in front of a live audience at Charles Darwin House in London back in November 2010. It was part of a UK tour by intelligent design proponent Mike Behe. And I had the opportunity to bring him together with noted scientist and priest Michael Rice, an advocate of theistic evolution. I do hope you enjoy their interaction. Thanks for tuning in, and don't forget you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
I'm going to concentrate on the question, should intelligent design be taught as science? Because I think that's the controversial part of it. And my answer is a qualified yes. It's if any other theory that purports to explain the appearance of design in nature is taught as science, then yes, it should be. And the arguments I'm going to use today have been published in a book called Divine Action and Natural Selection about a year ago. And this is taken from my chapter in that book. And in that, I noted that science, the word science, is not coextensive with rationality. Science is the activity of investigating nature by means of systematic observation, measurement, and classification. But other modes of reasoning are more fundamental than science. For example, mathematics, logic, perception of existence itself, and especially perception of other minds. Basic points to remember as I speak. A fundamental facet of rationality is our ability to discern the existence of other minds. In our world, we perceive other minds through their physical effects. A theory which arbitrarily rules out mind as an explanation for certain physical effects has abandoned a facet of reason. Abandoning a facet of reason leads ultimately to irrationality. So those are some basic points, but here's the structure of my argument for today. First, life reeks of design, simply reeks of design. Another theory, Darwinism, purports to explain the appearance of design in nature, but that is a very questionable assertion. Since Darwinism is taught as science, then intelligent design should also be taught as science. Failure to do so leads to irrationality. What is intelligent design? Well, if you look in the dictionary, one definition is the purposeful or inventive arrangement of parts or details. And we can simplify that to design is the purposeful arrangement of parts, which means that we infer design, we conclude design has occurred whenever parts appear to be arranged to accomplish a function. In other words, we infer the mental by means of the physical. Now, that's a bunch of words. It's oftentimes good to see an example of such a thing. And here I have a cartoon of something called the Far Side, which is popular in the United States. And in the cartoon, we have a troop of jungle explorers, but the lead explorer has been strung up and skewered by some sort of a trap. Now, the point is that everyone in this room looks at the cartoon, and you immediately realize that this was designed. That was not an accident. And the question is, how do you know it was designed? Is it a religious conclusion? Probably not. You know it's designed because you see a number of parts arranged to fulfill a purpose. The purposeful arrangement of parts. Okay, so now that we know what intelligent design is, I'm going to go through the points of my argument. The first one is that life reeks of design. And as an authority on the subject, I will invoke Professor Richard Dawkins of Oxford University in 1986 in his classic Blind Watchmaker. On the very first page of the very first chapter of the book, he said the following: biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So let me note, that is the very definition of biology, according to Professor Dawkins. The study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And how do we why, he of course doesn't think that they were designed for a purpose, but why does he think they even appear to be designed for a purpose? Well, he says, we may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose. Any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed just by looking at the structure of the object. So it's the purposeful arrangement of parts, in other words. So he agrees that we recognize design by the purposeful arrangement of parts. Additionally, he agrees that life reeks of design. He says the living results of natural selection, of course he's a Darwinist and attributes the design to that, overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design. So we're not talking little, like seeing faces in the clouds or something. There's an overwhelming appearance of design, according to Richard Dawkins. And he's not telling you the half of it. In the past 30 to 50 years, science has discovered that life is run by machines, literally machines made of molecules. This is the table of contents from an issue of the journal Cell from 1998. And as you can see, it has articles such as "The Cell is a Collection of Protein Machines," "Polymerases and the Replisome, Machines Within Machines," "Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome," "Motors, Clocks, Springs and Things." Now here's a figure of a molecular machine called a psyllium. I'm not going to tell you what its purpose is or how it works, and it was not one of those listed on the table of contents earlier. I just want to show you where it's published. This is an image that was published in the journal Nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, like the machines that humans are trying to build that work at the molecular level. Life already has machinery at that level. I'm going to skip this in the interests of time. Another theory, Darwinism, purports to explain the appearance of design in nature, and I'm just going to rely on Professor Douglas Fatuma, the president of the Society for the Study of Evolution, to support me on that. He says that the reason that natural selection is important is it's the central idea that explains design in nature. Before Darwin, the adaptations and complexity of organisms were ascribed to creation by an omnipotent designer. So it was real design before Darwin, but Darwinism claims to explain design. But that is a very questionable assertion. And for this, I'm going to just rely on one quote from a man named Franklin Harold, who's an emeritus professor of biochemistry at Colorado State University. And in discussing my book about 9 years ago, he said, "We should reject as a matter of principle the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity, but we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations." Next to the last point is that, okay, since Darwinism is taught as a science, then intelligent design should also be taught. And I'm going to quote myself in support of that. I wrote, In proposing explanations for nature, we must use all of the data and all of the rational faculties we have. The end result of the stubborn adherence to a simplistic division of nature into discoverable mechanics and undiscoverable purpose, I say, is nothing less than the official divorce of science from reason. And failure to do that, I think, leads to irrationality, a particular type of irrationality called solipsism. Now, solipsism can come in stronger or weaker forms, but it's actually the denial either that other minds exist or that we can perceive their existence. A less extreme form of solipsism, I think, but solipsism nonetheless, is when we rule out a priori other minds as an explanation for certain events, which Darwinism, in fact, does. And I think that's my argument for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was Mike Behe's opening statements on why he feels intelligent design is a credible challenge to Darwinian evolution. Here's Michael Rice making the case against intelligent design.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be given the opportunity to debate intelligent design with Mike Behe. In these opening remarks of mine, I'd like to say a bit about science and intelligent design, a bit about theology and intelligent design, and a bit about education and intelligent design. So first, a bit about science and intelligent design. Science is a very particular way of interrogating the world, and one of its characteristics is that it makes no mention of God. That does not mean that science disproves God. Rather, it means that science operates without presuming anything about God's existence or actions. There is a famous and probably true story that when Napoleon met Laplace, Napoleon asked Laplace why there was not even a single mention of God in Laplace's work. "Sir," replied Laplace, "I have no need of that hypothesis." By this, Laplace did not mean that he was an atheist. He was not. It's simply that science does not admit to the actions of a deity or any other supreme being or intelligent designer who is outside of objective physical reality. There is nothing immoral or intellectually dishonest or disreputable about appealing to a deity or an intelligent designer to explain the wonders of biochemistry, human consciousness, the existence of a universe, or a myriad of other matters that science cannot at present explain. But it is, I would suggest, somewhat premature. In one sense, science has been around since the dawn of humanity, and yet the rise of organized professional science is a recent phenomenon. The majority of the career scientists who have ever existed are alive today. Of course, I may be wrong, but my prediction is that 30 years from now, most of the examples cited by those who believe in intelligent design will be adequately explained by conventional science. Let me now turn to theology and intelligent design. Here, I think there may be more in common between Mike Behe and myself. They're not perhaps complete agreement. If I understand his writings correctly, Mike Behe is not saying that a god or other intelligent designer necessarily interfered in the course of history so that an ancestral bacterium flagellum, for example, was miraculously constructed. Rather, it is possible that the universe itself was conceived in such a way that eventually remarkable structures, such as the bacterial flagellum, and I might add the human mind, would evolve. To be more precise about my position, I do not think that there is anything in the world around us that serves as a proof of God's existence. In that sense, I reject the intelligent design explanation of some of the wonders of the world. However, if one has a religious faith, then of course one can make certain inferences about the Almighty from one's observations of the natural world. There isn't time now to go into this in any depth, but God seems, if it isn't silly to use this sort of language, to value diversity, to believe in the virtue of creation making itself, and to be in no great rush about things. Finally, let me just say a little about intelligent design and education. Might be he works in the USA and I work in the United Kingdom, and the two countries have very different school systems and legislation about the teaching of religious education. In the UK, by and large, intelligent design and creationism are better addressed in religious education lessons than in science lessons. I am not saying that science teachers should be prohibited from discussing such matters. Indeed, I'm all in favour of students critically examining arguments for and against the theory of evolution. However, religious education teachers are generally better at handling philosophical debate. Science teachers generally prefer and are at their best when they stick to matters of science. Thank you very much.
Well, after those opening statements, both the guests, Michael Behe and Michael Rice, joined me at the table, and we had a free-flowing discussion on some of the aspects of intelligent design and evolution and why our guests felt so differently on the subject. And for the sake of distinguishing between them more easily, I opted to call Michael Behe Mike and Michael Rice Michael. So if you hear Mike or Michael, that's how you'll distinguish between them. Here's what they had to say as we got into our discussion.
I think we'd be best starting with the science of this, because I think that's where ultimately a lot of people say, Mike, the science simply doesn't match up to the claims you're making. We didn't see it today, but you have a classic example of the bacterial flagellum in the cell. This is a small, almost, you could call it an outboard motor that drives bacteria through the fluid of the cell. And in your book, Darwin's Black Box, it was one of the key examples you had of a so-called irreducibly complex biomolecular machine, something where all the parts are needed for it to do the job it does, and you claimed that couldn't have arisen by a gradualistic Darwinian process whereby things are added bit by bit. If it was going to do the job it had to do, they all had to be there in the first place. Lots of people have said, actually, you've been disproved on a number of occasions. People have shown an evolutionary pathway. What's your response to some of the critics of this particular argument?
Well, I don't want to speak ill of my critics, of course, but I think they are accepting easy explanations. They're not being very rigorous at all. Most of the supposed refutations simply compare protein sequences and say why this protein in the bacterial flagellum looks like this other protein over here and this one looks like that one over here. But in order to get, even if that were true, and even if other proteins eventually join together to give a bacterial flagellum, that is still a problem in irreducible complexity, because until all of the proteins get together, and proteins have to bind by having very specific complementary binding sites to each other. If they're not together already, then they have to develop those, and that's a very difficult evolutionary problem. Then the problem of irreducible complexity remains. And as a matter of fact, that problem of getting two proteins to bind together is a problem in getting several changes in each protein so that the geometrical and the chemical properties of each surface match each other. And it's been recently agreed by several papers, especially one reviewed by a man named Eugene Koonin, that it's still an unsolved problem in biochemistry of how we could even get two coordinated changes in two amino acid positions. And if a bacterial flagellum consists of at least several dozen proteins, as well as many auxiliary proteins that are necessary, and if each of those binding sites needs three or four or five amino acid changes to create it, although I shouldn't use that word, then it's a horrendous problem, and they're overlooking many difficult steps.
Well, obviously, Mike says, Michael, that the science definitely shows that these things couldn't have arisen by the process of Darwinian evolution. I mean, but for you, is an inference, therefore, to design simply out of the question, or do you believe that we will always ultimately find, if we keep looking hard enough, a Darwinian explanation?
I think if we look at the moment at examples such as the bacterial flagellum that are cited as providing support for the idea of intelligent design, then both intelligent design and standard Darwinian explanations of evolution have to admit they haven't got yet the whole story. We do not have, within the Darwinian understanding of life, complete explanations about how many, many, many things arose. That's really why I was arguing that it's just a prediction of mine, and I'm quite prepared in principle for that to be thought to be a mistaken prediction, that as time goes by, more and more of the examples cited as being irreducibly complex will be shown not to be, for one of a number of reasons. Either we'll realise that actually you can reduce them a bit, that simpler versions have some useful purpose that works quite well. Or people might begin to work out the evolutionary course of events that led to them. But these structures arose, as many of you will know, literally, if one accepts the Darwinian evolution of life, they arose literally thousands of millions of years ago, and they don't leave tangible fossils. So it is not going to always be easy to work out the origins. But I think most scientists would hold that to deduce from those sorts of points that the structures are irreducibly complex is something of a scientific counsel of despair. There have been many occasions in the course of science where things have appeared to lack all possible explanation, and it's taken huge advances and sometimes decades of further work to get to grips with understanding them.
I mean, this is a classic problem that people often throw at intelligent design. It is a science stopper, they say, Mike. It doesn't actually solve anything. It just says, we're throwing our hands up, it's a mystery, God did it. What do you say to that?
Okay, let me answer that, and I'd really like to respond to Michael, a couple of points he made. The first is that, people have said that before in the history of science, that some theory is a science stopper. And the most recent was, say, the Big Bang Theory. About 100 years or so ago, most physicists thought that the universe was eternal and unchanging. And then in the 1930s, measurements were made that seemed to show that galaxies were receding from each other and from the Earth. And that was the beginning of the Big Bang Theory. Now, if you look at writings from the times, from that time, many scientists simply hated the Big Bang Theory. They said they thought that it suggested a beginning which was like a creation event and seemed to have theological implication. And there was a German chemist, Walter Nernst, who I think won the Nobel Prize, whose work is still studied today, who said that the notion of a beginning to the universe is ipso facto unscientific. Science needs an eternal universe in order to work. But nonetheless, physics went along and ignored Nernst's counsel and has made a lot of progress. Even if it turns out that the Big Bang Theory would be overturned tomorrow, nonetheless, working under it has been very fruitful. And so the point is that I think we should ignore whether a theory has any extra scientific implications and just ask whether it seems to fit the data or not. And one point I'd like to respond to Michael's that he's made is I'll bet you £10 that in 30 years we will not have solved many of these examples. And And I'm not just trying to be funny, but if you look at, here's an article from the journal Nature from 6 months ago. It was an issue that had some features that celebrated the 10th anniversary of the human genome, sequencing the human genome. And for those who can see it, the title is Life is Complicated. As a matter of fact, it's a whole lot more complicated than it was 10 years ago before the human genome was sequenced. Let me just read a few quotes from people. It says, as sequencing and other new technologies spew forth data, the complexity of biology has seemed to grow by orders of magnitude. It seems like we're climbing a mountain that keeps getting higher and higher, says Jennifer Doudna, a biochemist at the University of California, Berkeley. The more we know, the more we realize there is to know. And there's other quotes, but I won't do those. Biochemistry is not getting simpler. It's getting more complex than I knew about in 1996 when I wrote Darwin's Black Box. And there's no particular reason to think that we have plumbed the depths of biology yet. I was going to make a point, but I forgot.
Well, I'd like to make a point, and let Michael come in here as well. But I mean, essentially, is there any reason why an inference to design is simply not allowed in science? I mean, you say it's a science stopper, but if that's where the evidence leads, shouldn't we go down that path, Michael?
As I'm sure you know, Justin, the problem is not with an inference to design, as Mike quite rightly illustrated. People like Richard Dawkins are perfectly happy with the idea that life appears designed. It's whether your explanation for the way in which living organisms work sits within science or sits outside of it. And my point, which is a really standard one in history and philosophy of science, is simply that science operates within certain limits, and the idea of an intelligent designer sits without that. And I'm not sure that I agree with Mike that his example about the Big Bang actually fits his argument that well, because while I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea that some scientists didn't like the idea of the Big Bang because they felt it favoured a traditional Jewish or Christian understanding of the origin of the universe, I'm absolutely certain that it was not the case that mainstream science refused to countenance the theory. On the contrary, mainstream science was absolutely comfortable at having in parallel ideas about the universe being unchanging and about having a definite beginning. Gradually, the weight of evidence shifted over a number of years to the Big Bang. That is fundamentally different from what's going on with intelligent design, where for over a decade of its existence, it has completely failed to make inroads into the corpus of science.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show. In the last week, we featured Mike Behe, the famous intelligent design proponent from America, on the programme. He joined me at Westminster Chapel for an evening, and many of you turned out to see him there. But we had in the afternoon a special debate organised between him and Michael Rice, who is the former Director of Education at the Royal Society, now part of the Institute of Education. And they were discussing whether intelligent design is pseudoscience or a credible challenge to Darwinian evolution. We've been hearing the first part of their discussion and the first part of the programme. We're going to continue to hear it now as we continue to hear why Mike Behe believes that intelligent design is a credible challenge to Darwinian evolution. And Michael Rice responds, and we're going to be hearing some of the Q&A that arose from the audience of invited Christian, secular representatives and scientists in the audience. Here's more from what happened on that day in November earlier in the week.
Do you believe, Mike, that intelligent design is ever going to have a chance of becoming the dominant paradigm? I mean, do you ever see a day in which Darwinian evolution fails to become the dominant scientific paradigm?
Oh, yes, I sure do. Anti-Darwinism, or people who are skeptical of Darwinism, is much more widespread than intelligent design is in science. people, intelligent design is regarded, proponents are regarded as pariahs and outcasts. But there are many people who say, Darwin got it wrong, but look at my theory over here. The cutoff is whether one invokes a theory which involves intelligence or not. But many, many biologists are dissatisfied with Darwin's theory. And let me just I like Michael's point that he says that question is the answer going to be within science or outside science? And that's an interesting point. But I think most people are interested in, is the answer true or is the answer not true? And if the answer, in fact, does lie outside somebody's definition of science, then the question is, what do scientists do who want to stick with the same definition? Do they claim that we have no answer? Do they claim that we will get an answer in science? Do they claim we already have an answer in science? And do they teach children that we already have an answer in science? And that science, essentially, because it has limits, I don't know about in the United Kingdom, but in the United States, it's often implied science can explain everything. And if they say we've got an answer, then no other answer is necessary. We have no need of that hypothesis, in other words.
And again, there may be some agreement here between Mike and myself, because I, too, do not want children to be taught that science can explain everything. Not only can it factually not explain everything, but again, Mike and I think we'll be in agreement. There are some things that will forever lie without the scope of science. You correctly said mathematics is more fundamental. One does not establish the sum of the internal angles of a flat triangle through scientific methods. Mathematics, in that sense, operates quite separately from the way in which scientific truth is gradually built up. And if one thinks, for example, about arguments in moral philosophy, they cannot be reduced to science, so I'm with you on that. But it is the case that I think children in school should be introduced to the fact that the best explanation we have for the diversity of life, in scientists' understanding, is the scientific account of the theory of evolution.
I disagree that it's the best explanation we've got. I came prepared. I've got another paper here. This one from Cell. It's called A Golden Age for Evolutionary Genetics? And he's going to say essentially no. The last sentence in the abstract reads the following. Most studies of recent evolution in nature involve the loss of traits, and we still understand little of the genetic changes needed in the origin of novel traits. So we do not know that Darwinian processes could produce what we see. We do not have evidence for it. It may be true, as Michael says, that most scientists think we do, but that's not quite the same thing. And schools, I don't think, in science class, should just teach children what scientists think, because the children are going to grow up to be citizens and make decisions about scientific matters as responsible citizens. They should see more broadly than just what scientists think.
But there was this watershed legal case in the States 5 years ago.
What was that?
It was called, for those who aren't aware of this, it was a major sort of a turning point, if you like, in the arguments about intelligent design. The 2005 Kitzmiller versus Dover School District law case. You were one of the witnesses for the defence, and this was the issue of a school board that had said that at science lessons, a statement had to be read out, essentially saying that theory of evolution is just a theory, and that there are significant problems with it, and there are resources available to look at on intelligent design. This created a strong backlash from some of the parents who brought a lawsuit against the school board. So you were there speaking, obviously, in favour of intelligent design and that it should be on the curriculum. But the words of the judge, he ruled that intelligent design is a religious proposition and it was completely thrown out. Perhaps we'll start with you, Michael, here, and then come for a response from Mike. Do you see intelligent design as a religious proposition primarily, Michael?
It is perfectly possible to conceive of intelligent design as a theory that makes no reference whatsoever towards religion. So philosophically, that could be the case. At the same time, I think my understanding is that the judge was convinced that historically, when you look carefully at those people who most support intelligent design, you find that they're almost always card-carrying Christians. When you look at the writings that are used to support intelligent design, you sometimes find that they have, if I might say so, evolved, I suppose, thinking aloud, by single-step mutations from creationist ancestors to the substitution of the phrase intelligent design for creationism.
So you would agree that there is, if you like, no smoke without fire, as it were, when it comes to intelligent design and those who are the most forceful in trying to push it into schools and into places like that, that there is a religious agenda going on?
There typically has been so far, but to repeat, I'm very comfortable with the idea that one can conceive logically of a discipline of intelligent design that would not need to make reference to any deity.
Mike, I mean, your tour is very much about distinguishing intelligent design from a religious kind of viewpoint, isn't it?
That's right, and we should remember as academics, and I think there are plenty of academics in the room, that it does not matter who suggests an idea. It doesn't matter if an idea was suggested by, say, Mother Teresa or by the National Association of Axe Murderers. The question is the proposition true? And it doesn't matter if people in Dover, Pennsylvania, in addition to making the statement, think the earth is young and do all sorts of conniving to get their curriculum change, at least, you know, as a matter of academic interest, as a matter of legal interest, it might be interesting. It only matters whether the arguments and evidence for it seem to add up. I present myself here as a person who does not fit the description of the typical person that Michael talked about. I used to believe in Darwin's theory. I was taught Darwin's theory in parochial school. I was essentially a theistic evolutionist like Michael is now, and I changed my mind because of the scientific evidence. I had no theological difficulties with Darwinism. But because of the things I wrote about in my book, I no longer think that Darwin's theory is in fact true. So the Kitzmiller trial is an interesting diversion, and it might have caused some sociological difficulties for intelligent design. But what Judge Jones wrote about the truth of Darwinism versus the truth of intelligent design versus anything else is simply, you know, a judge's opinion. And he did not study philosophy, he did not study science. He copied most of his opinion from documents given to him by the lawyers for one side. And so it really shouldn't affect other people's opinions.
Obviously, you believe in Darwinian evolution. It doesn't compromise your Christian faith, Michael. Do you see problems with the theological implications of intelligent design? Is that itself a problem for you, that God would act in a way whereby certain biomolecular machines have, as it were, been produced, presumably, by God? They didn't arise by the, as it were, laws of nature that God has set in place.
I wouldn't go quite as far as to say that I personally see a theological problem with intelligent design, because intelligent design, in a sense, theologically, has an ancestry that goes back 2,000 years and is perfectly respectable within mainstream theology. I have to say, though, that I myself, theologically, prefer the notion that God gives, as it were, an ability to all of creation to unfold itself from the very beginning, and therefore that everything we see around us within the natural and the human-made world can indeed either be explained, or at least in principle can be explained, within a consistent, coherent, scientific set of understandings.
Well, I agree with much of what Michael says. Theologically, I don't know, maybe it is more elegant for God to create a universe which can unfold. I don't know. But as a scientist, we're supposed to look at the universe and come up with ideas of how it came to be, rather than getting our ideas from prior notions of theology. And these days, I don't think one has to... I think one can view that the universe unfolded, but all you have to do, and many theistic evolutionists do, is to suppose that God created a very specific universe, knowing that it would unfold, you know, giving it, you know, the constants of the laws of physics and so on, knowing that it would unfold in a certain direction to produce life. One can view intelligent design, and I've written about this in my more recent book, you can just view intelligent design as implying a much more fine-tuned universe, that not only did God set up the universe to unfold so that there would be planets, so that there would be water with certain properties and so on, but so that the origin of life would occur, not as a result of laws, but as an incident or a unique incident, maybe following laws, but a very, very improbable event, but which God chose that universe to allow to happen. And one can do that for all the other systems that I write about. So I don't think, as you said in your beginning, I don't think there has to be any interference by God, and that's a loaded word itself, in the development of the universe. And the universe can unfold according to the natural laws that God made. Intelligent design is just saying, yes, but it at least unfolded a whole lot further by the plan of God than we previously thought.
Now, this is where, if I can now be almost a little bit patronizing, intelligent design is a pretty broad camp. And Mike is, at, not surprisingly, the academically extremely respectable end of it, given that he's a professor of biochemistry. And the arguments he's just been advancing are extremely close to ones that actually the great majority of atheistic scientists would just about, although somewhat grudgingly, be prepared to begin to accept. Because what he was saying, in a sense, again, if I understood correctly, is that all these examples that are the iconic ones often talked about, like hemoglobin or the immune system or the bacterial flagellum, or in Darwin's time, the mammalian eye, may indeed not need any sort of miraculous, supernatural explanation. They're indicative of a design that goes back right to the very beginning of the universe itself. Well, I'm not surprised you're really comfortable with that. But that again means that the arguments begin to sit outside of what is testable within science. They're more a sort of metaphysical worldview, which is of great interest and importance, but is not something that's very amenable to the day-to-day practices of science.
Quick response, Mike, and then I'll just want to, one final topic before we have to conclude the discussion.
Okay. I agree with Michael. You can get very technical in here, but I don't think that what I'm proposing could easily be mixed up with what an atheistic scientist would propose. I think if at least a Darwinistic atheistic scientist would have to say that if life could unfold by a Darwinian random mutation natural selection, then if we had enough trials, we should be able to see Darwinian evolution do something interesting too. And you may know of the experiments of a man named Richard Lenski at Michigan State University. He's a fellow who grew bacteria for a long time, and bacteria reproduce quickly, so they've gone through actually 50,000 generations since he started, which is about a million years for large animals like humans, and trillions of bacteria, many, many, many. And he did it specifically because he wanted to see what would evolve. And what did evolve? It turns out that there were a number of adaptive mutations, good mutations, that helped the bacteria grow faster than their brother bacteria in the flask. But when he then went and asked what exactly happened to the DNA, what were the identity of those mutations, it turned out that essentially all of them broke genes or threw genes away or downregulated genes, essentially losing information rather than gaining information. He saw nothing that looked like it was on its way to some new complex biochemical system.
This is a bit difficult because some people in the room will know this example in great detail. Other people will be wondering what on earth are we talking about. Very briefly, exactly as Mike says, this is a lab experiment. It's been running for about 20 years. You generally find when you run experiments for long periods of time with organisms in very, very artificial environments, that change indeed, exactly as Mike says, comes by simplification. There are examples where we know within human history where organisms have actually become more complicated. The classic one is when, as in many plant species, you get what's called polyploidy, where there's a doubling of the chromosome number. And that's quite well recorded historically, and then gives rise to all sorts of potential in evolution. So that's an example of the opposite phenomenon, namely where within a short period of time, within the last 100 years or so, the amount of genetic information increases typically by a factor of 2. But to undermine what I've just said, the trouble is all these things, we're just talking at the most about 100 years. And it is really difficult to get one's mind around what might have happened in 3,500 million years over the Earth's surface, as opposed to 20 years in one lab.
Okay, this is actually the area I wanted to move to, so you've preempted me. So a couple more minutes, gents, and then we'll draw things to a close.
I'll just make one short comment, and that is I don't know about the state of schools in the United Kingdom, but in schools in the United States, biology textbooks are not shy about saying that we do know what happened in 3.5 billion years, and we know that it was Darwinian processes, and they have dinosaurs, and they have little arrows pointing to birds and to bunny rabbits and so on. And the student is to infer that natural selection and random mutation can take care of that, whereas we do not know that. And so essentially the textbooks tell students things that professional biologists know not to be true.
If you're, I can't be held fully responsible for the state of US textbooks on evolution, but on a more positive note to finish with, like you, I would love to see improved quality of school textbooks in this country as well as in the States about evolution, and evolution is not especially well taught. I'm with you on that as well.
Please join me in giving a hand to both Michael and Mike.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as the discussion finished, we took half an hour's break for people to mill around, to get to know each other, have tea and coffee and refreshments, and to also hand in their questions for the question and answer session. And we took various people to a microphone, and they were able to ask questions of both my guests today on the issue of intelligent design. You're listening to a special recording that took place of a debate between Michael Rice, formerly of the Royal Society, debating Mike Behe, world-famous intelligent design proponent. I was hosting that debate at Charles Darwin House earlier this week, and we're going to continue hearing what they said in response to some of the questions that arose from the floor.
Well, perhaps we could start off with Peter Cooper, who has a question which is fairly fundamental to this on teaching these things in school.
Yes, hi. My question is really based on how do you view science, in that one definition of science is to exclude God from it. One definition of science might be to include God, since the idea of God having created a universe that we could understand, that is understandable by rational human beings, is a presupposition of science. And so in listening to the two presentations, I thought, well, who is the most scientific of the two? And it seemed to me that Mike was the more scientific of the two in his approach to explaining what he thought. And so in thinking this, I thought, well, hang on, if we're looking at where this a subject should be taught, just from what I've heard today, intelligent design sits very comfortably within teaching of science, but an atheistic view of the world and Darwinism sits more comfortably with teaching of religious education. And my question is, should in fact Darwinism and atheism be taught in religious education?
Do you want to start with that, Mike?
Yeah. I'm just going to be completely pragmatic now, because a lot of education is about what works. So the reason why one should not rely in the United Kingdom on Darwinism, which is not a very good term, evolutionary biology being addressed in religious education, is because most religious education teachers don't know enough about it. That's exactly the same reason, as I said, why one should not deal in the United Kingdom with intelligent design, primarily in science lessons, simply because most science teachers don't know enough about it. As I said, I don't want to ban science teachers from talking about issues of intelligent design, but in this country, unlike the States, we are really fortunate. Most schools, you have lessons in RE, you have lessons in science, and RE can do a superb job of tackling issues to do with ethics, philosophy, and in this particular instance, there are, for year 9, that's for 13, 14-year-olds, there are some suggested units which get pupils quite explicitly to compare creationism, intelligent design, evolution and biology. In science lessons, yep, get them to say, I don't accept evolution, and then get them to look at the evidence, okay, that's ideal, but do never get into discussion, for example, about scripture or anything like that in science lessons.
Well, we don't have religious education in public schools in the United States, so the question is, where might these ideas be discussed? And in general, I think that whenever you bring up a topic such as the origin of life, which has obvious implications, a variety of implications, like scientific, philosophical, even theological, then you should be prepared to discuss all of those. And if the teacher is not prepared, then teachers, colleges perhaps could be changed a bit to prepare them. I think Darwinism, it's perfectly... in schools in the United States, most science textbooks start off with the statement that science simply studies matter and its interactions, and essentially... we leave God out of it sort of statement. But then they do not go on to say that therefore our view of the world may be incomplete. It's kind of like the little warning on cigarette packages or something, it's unobtrusive and it's never repeated. I think that if students were taught that some of these things have implications across disciplines, and that some people argue for different points of view, and that there are big open questions in our understanding of this, then the whole matter would be a lot less controversial than it currently is.
I'll ask the microphone next to go to Marilyn Watson, if she's here. And while it's crossing over to her, if you'd make yourself known, Marilyn, I'm just going to ask a question on behalf of Dr. Elizabeth Allen, who is in genetics herself, and says, could Professor Michael Behe just quickly, I'm going to say, give a couple of examples of irreducible complexity? Marilyn feels this is, Elizabeth, I should say, feels this is where the arguments of intelligent design really lie, and she'd just like... briefly, a couple of key examples of irreducible complexity in biology.
Sure. Well, one the poster example is the bacterial flagellum, where it has a number of components. It's like an outward motor. It has a propeller. It's got a motor. It's got parts to attach it to the motor to the propeller. It's got bushing to keep materials from leaking out of the cell. It's got dozens of parts. There's an other system called for protein transport. Proteins are in the eukaryotic cell, which is eukaryotes are advanced organisms like us. They have many compartments in their cell, and when the protein is first made, it has to be transported. Some proteins have to be transported through barriers, through membranes, sometimes through several membranes, to the correct compartment where it's supposed to do its job. And in that process, the protein comes out, and it generally has a signal on the end, essentially like a postal address on it, which tells machinery in the cell to grab onto it and take it over to the compartment that is to receive it. And then there's machinery in the compartment that recognizes the protein and will thread it through the membrane.
You're listening to a special recording of a live version of the programme that took place in front of an audience of scientists, Christian and secular representatives on the issue of intelligent design, pseudoscience or credible challenge to Darwinian evolution. My guests on the programme, Michael Behe and Michael Rice. Michael Behe in favour, of course, of intelligent design, Michael Rice against. We'll be continuing to hear their discussion and their answers to the questions that arose from the floor in the next section of the programme in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The last section of the programme now, as we continue to hear some of the questions and answers that took place at a special recording of this programme at Charles Darwin House in London. We were discussing the question, intelligent design, pseudoscience or credible challenge to Darwinian evolution. My guests were Mike Behe, who of course was on a tour in the last week called Darwin or Design. He is a famous proponent of intelligent design over from the States, and he was in conversation with Michael Wright, who has had roles in education, is a scientist and a Christian himself, but believes intelligent design is a very misguided way of looking at science. Here's some more of the questions that arose. This one came, in this instance, from Marilyn Watson.
Why did God intelligently design predators and parasites? Which leads to the deeper question of that intelligent design doesn't actually tell us anything about what God is like. So it doesn't bring us any further forward theologically, neither does it bring us any further forward scientifically. So what's the point?
Who's that question?
Well, I think that's primarily towards you, Mike, and then we'll have Michael respond as well.
Okay, well, I'm a scientist. I'm not a theologian, and I think the problem you're referring to comes under the topic of the problem of evil. Why are there evil things in the world? And happily, that's not a biochemical topic. And so I would refer you to the theologians in the group. But, you know, just as a layman in the area, I do think malaria was designed. As a matter of fact, I say it so specifically in my second book because it's got very sophisticated machinery for invading human red blood cells and so on. With all of these things, like tiger fangs, which can cause people trouble, some organisms might damage humans, but they may do a whole range of other tasks in the biosphere. And overall, they may be necessary for life in the world. Malaria does not just live to infect people. Tigers don't live to eat people. So it may be that on balance, we are ignorant of many of the relationships, many of the roles of things that can sometimes do us harm. As an analogy, we know that that plate tectonics is overall good, but it can cause earthquakes and tsunamis and so on. But there's no reason to think that the processes causing plate tectonics were specifically put in place in order to hurt us. But that's just a layman's view of it.
I'd like to ask Michael the same question in the sense that
the problem of suffering and the world we live in isn't just a problem for intelligent design. It's, if you like, on any Christian worldview, it's an issue. Does a Darwinian evolutionary understanding help us to explain that better, to come to a rationalisation of it?
I'm glad to have a minute and a half just to deal with the problem of suffering, because it'll be good to sort that out, I feel now. So I admit that the most generous comment to what I'm about to say would probably be that it's the sketch of what might be developed into an argument. So 2 points. You asked the Darwinian question. The original question was a theological one. The Darwinian one is much the easier to give, of course, because the Darwinian understanding of life is that, roughly speaking, you do whatever makes you more likely to survive and leave offspring. So, for example, ordinary, let's say, omnivores and herbivores over evolutionary time evolve the ability to feel pain. Because if you don't feel pain, you're in trouble. Some of you know that there's a thankfully very small number of people, about 100 who've ever been known, who have a congenital condition, these are humans, where they can't feel pain. Practically all these people die before they're 20, and there's, I think, been no recorded instance of them ever having a child. They get ulcerations, their limbs get horribly damaged, they suffer from infections and so on. So pain is simply one of those things which has evolved, because if you don't evolve it, you're extinct. Now, the theological answers, of course, take a little bit longer, but they usually, and this is only the present consensus of the last couple of decades within theology, so it may move, but the usual argument goes something like as follows. In one sense, God is omnipotent, and it's fine to say that, but you can't have God who starts making circles square, or the classic silly example of bachelors who are married. There are certain things that are just not possible. It is therefore possible to conceive that if you are to have a universe with wonderful diversity and sentient creatures such as ourselves and many others, and organisms who have the possibility eventually to respond to a creator, then that world, that universe, is going to be a world which also has unpleasant things within it. And therefore, roughly speaking, if you are a deity, you have a choice. You either have such a world or you do not.
Thank you. Let's go from theology to atheism. And Paul Sims is here from New Humanist magazine, who represents a lot of the secular and atheist world. And I think you've got a couple of questions here, Paul. I wonder if you'd like to ask the question about Dawkins and his approach to this whole area. I should say that I originally did approach Richard Dawkins to contribute to today's discussion, and received back a note from him that he never gives creationists the oxygen of publicity by sharing a platform with them. And that kind of gives the background to, I think, the question you had.
Yeah, so this is for Michael Rice, really. So as you say, Dawkins says that you shouldn't give a platform to people like Michael Behe. But you welcome the debate yourself. Why do you feel this is a productive approach compared to what Dawkins says?
Well, first of all, I do have a certain sympathy with Richard Dawkins, in the sense that he is obviously inundated with a number of requests to participate in debates and gives talks that most of us can hardly imagine. So it's a rather different scale in terms of how often I get asked to participate in debates or give talks. But there are people with whom I would refuse to debate, because I would think, roughly speaking, it just was not helpful to the world or was a waste of time. And I'm delighted to say that debating with somebody who sincerely believes intelligent design is the best explanation we have for certain features of the natural world seems to me both perfectly respectable and intellectually quite interesting. And it's an important issue. And because my passion is for education and how we educate the next generation, I'm really rather concerned at the idea that there are certain ideas that we would almost try and do all we can to silence.
Do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, I would applaud.
I mean, how do you feel about being labelled a creationist by Richard Dawkins?
Yes, well, that's inaccurate. I mean, when we use the word creationist in the United States, it's often a young earth creationist, who believes the earth is roughly 10,000 years old and so on. And the use of the word creationist for somebody like in my position is just a rhetorical move to try to put the negative baggage that that position has historically carried onto what I hope is most people think is a debatable, reasonable position. It's like calling somebody a communist because they say they favor increasing Social Security in the United States by 5%.
So do you believe Richard Dawkins is in some sense ducking the issue by labeling what you're doing as creationism?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Could we have Dr. George Grimble?
I think he genuinely, by coincidence, I know, happened to have to go to the teaching commitment.
Well, I tell you what, I'll ask. No, you're absolutely right, because the reason I've got this is he asked me to read it out. So my, that was my mistake. I think to Mike first, and then perhaps the same question to Michael. Is the concept of intelligent design or of evolution amenable to experimental falsification? Now, in a sense, you touched on this with this issue of this Lenski bacterial experiment, and you say that showed from a laboratory point of view, Mike, that no positive, if you like, accumulation of complexity occurred over millions of generations of this bacteria. So you feel that evolution has been falsified in some sense?
Well, no, I don't. I would answer it this way. Most people say that intelligent design is unscientific because it's unfalsifiable. How are you going to put God in a test tube and test God? And I answer that I think, to my reading, the actual situation is directly opposite to what those people think, that intelligent design is easily falsifiable, but Darwinism isn't. And the way to falsify intelligent design is to do a Lenski-type experiment. If Lenski had, after, say, 50,000 generations, observed a strain of his bacteria that had adapted better than others, he examined it in detail, saw a couple of proteins, 3-4 interacting to do something new that they hadn't done before, something that I might term irreducibly complex, then I'd have a lot of explaining to do. My ideas would be in big trouble. But here's 50,000 generations later, and his experiment it's interesting. It's addressed some long-standing questions in evolutionary biology, like, you know, how fast does a mutation spread, and so on. But it has not produced anything like a complex system. So the question then for Darwinism is, does that falsify Darwinism? Or more broadly say something like, how would you falsify the proposition that Darwinian processes produce the bacterial flagellum experimentally? I don't think you can. You could always say that you didn't choose the right bacterial strain to start with. You didn't have the right selective conditions. You didn't let it go long enough, and so on. And all of those might be decent reasons, but it just means that you can't falsify Darwinian claims very easily. But ID, people have been trying to falsify ID claims since my book came out.
So the one is falsifiable and the other is not, as far as you can tell.
Yes.
How do you respond, Michael?
I've said probably enough about the extent to which I think intelligent design is or is not falsifiable. So let me try and concentrate a bit of the question, which is about Darwinian theory of evolution. Is that falsifiable? Mm. If we think back to Darwin's theory of natural selection, as originally propounded by himself and independently by Wallace, there were some parts of it for which there really wasn't especially good evidence at the day. I'm thinking in particular of the one about offspring resemble their parents, so the notion of hereditary. Now that, of course, subsequently, the next 150 years or so, has produced evidence that is so massively confirmatory that that bit of it can in any useful term just be considered a straightforward fact. We understand how offspring resemble their parents and why they occasionally don't and so on. But there are other parts of the Darwinian understanding of diversity that are much less amenable to standard interrogation through experiment. Classic examples are things that happened a very, very long time ago in the past. So we may or may not indirectly end up, for example, having a good understanding of how the cell, the fundamental unit of practically all life, how it came into existence with its various parts. But we may not. It's exactly the same in some other scientific disciplines, the classic one usually being astronomy. We may or may not have a good understanding about how our own soul system came into existence, but it'll always be through inference, through extrapolation, through being what is sometimes referred to as inference to the best explanation, arguments about economy of explanation and so on. It won't be an experimental test.
Thank you very much. Is Professor Michael Poole in the room? I think he is. There he is.
No, he isn't. I'm not a professor.
Oh, well, I apologise. I'm not giving you your correct title, but Mike, you certainly at least work at a university,
yes,
and in the area of biology. You've got a question about the God of the Gaps aspect of intelligent design.
Yes, as a Christian, I'm all in favour of intelligent design. The whole universe was designed by God, provided you spell it with a small I and a small D. When you come to intelligent design with a capital I and a capital D, I have a lot more reservations, and I think it's a counterproductive apologetic device for this reason. If you introduce the idea of specified complexity or irreducible complexity, the argument is that there are certain things that are so complex that you can't give a natural explanation to them, but they have to invoke the idea of a designer. That entails that there are some things that are not sufficiently complex, so you don't have to introduce the idea of a designer. Now, that seems to me contrary to Christian theology, because God is the maker and upholder of everything there is, the things we do understand and the things we don't. And to substitute God in the places that we can't understand is that traditional philosophical error of a type error in explanation of the God of the gaps, where you substitute God in where you can't do the science. Now, C.A. Coulson was our first professor of theoretical physics, a Christian man, and he said when that happens, the challenge is to become a better scientist, not to try and say, ah, here we found a bit you can't explain in science, that's God. And I think that's inescapable as a problem in the intelligent design movement, and I would ask for comments on that.
Mm, thank you very much. Do you want to start us off, Mike? On
yes, I was just wondering if we could meet in the middle and have a capital I, maybe a small D. well, okay, those are excellent questions. The first thing I would say is that I'm a Christian like yourself, and I think God's in charge of everything. I don't think that, you know, a sparrow falls to the ground without God's permission. But the question here is a scientific one. What can the methods of science, in my view, detect was beyond probability, statistics, and natural law? And so that's where I draw the line. We're talking about a scientific recognition of design rather than a religious one. Second is God of the gaps, and I disagree. Intelligent design is frequently accused of being a God of the gaps. You see this flagellum here, and what you do is you slap your head and you say, oh, look at that, so complex, we can't explain that, God must have done it. But that's not the argument for design. The argument for design is a positive one, like I tried to present today. It's the purposeful arrangement of parts. Whenever we see in a mousetrap, in an automobile, a computer, and that jungle trap, whenever we see parts arranged to fulfill a purpose, and there are subtleties into that I didn't have time to get into, but in general, whenever we see parts arranged for a purpose, especially when they're very complex and specifically fitting and so on, we have always found that they were the results of intelligent design. And now, much to our surprise, we have found such things in biology. And Darwinian claims notwithstanding, we have no explanation other than design for those things. So we do not conclude they were designed based on a God of the gaps. We don't conclude they were designed based on what we don't know. We conclude it based on what we do know. For me, it was a lot, would be a lot easier 50 years ago when we knew a whole lot less about the cell, a lot less about the machinery of the cell, to think that Darwinian evolution might be true. But now that we've discovered exactly how the, well, not exactly, but how sophisticated and elegant the cell is, that's what is pushing the argument for design, not a lack of knowledge.
Could we pass the microphone to the middle there? I think Peter S. Williams has a question for us. Yes, what did you want to ask, Peter?
Thanks very much. I was fascinated in your initial exchange to see Michael Rees saying that although he didn't think ID was true, you thought that it could be true, but that nevertheless it wasn't science. But I think that raises the following dilemma, to which I'd be interested in your response. Supposing ID were to turn out to be true, do you then bite the bullet and kind of send lots of resources from the science departments at the university to the philosophy department, the theology department, in order to further understand the way that nature really is? Or do you shift your definition of what we call science a bit to include ID? Which of those forks would you pick?
My own view is that if intelligent design really turns out to be true, it's going to need a lot more than a bit of shifting. It'll have completely and utterly fundamental implications, not only for the whole of science, but for the whole of theology. And, of course, I may always be wrong. I'm quite prepared to accept that, because, as Mike points out, science is all about leaving open-ended the possibility that things may change in ways one doesn't expect. But, and I think Mike himself has said this in some of his writing, it'll be a scientific revolution that'll make the sort of thing that T.S. Kuhn was writing about feel just like ripples on a pond.
We've got time for one more question, and I think, as I haven't had one from this side, just at the back there in the middle, Andrew Brown had a question. Microphone coming your way.
I was struck by the complaint that textbooks are inaccurate and don't tell the truth. I thought that was the job of textbooks. I mean, surely all school textbooks consists of things which you unlearn if you get to university. Isn't it a bit silly to complain that they're oversimplified?
Mike?
Yes, well, a lot of textbooks contain errors, but they generally tend to be random errors. If you look in biology textbooks, the errors, it's not really an error, it's a... it's an intentional adoption of the stance that Darwinian evolution is true, or at least that we can explain life without recourse to anything outside of the physical universe. So the mistakes, ten years ago, there's a famous example that these embryo pictures of... that appear in many textbooks showing similarities between mammals and fish and reptiles and so on were in fact grossly exaggerated, maybe just absolutely faked by a man named Ernst Haeckel. But they were included in that textbook because people thought they supported the current view of evolution. So random mistakes, kind of, that's noise. You can not worry too much about that if you don't have too much noise. But when you have mistakes all in one direction, they cease to be mistakes and they get to be prejudice and indoctrination. And that's what I think happens in many biology texts.
No answer. No comment for that yourself, Michael. But thank you for all the questions. It's been a fascinating time. Do please join me in thanking both our guests, Michael Rees and Andrew Deakin.
Well, there you go. We didn't have time to include all the questions that came up in that section, but you got a good cross-section of them there. I do hope you've enjoyed today's programme. We've been hearing a discussion that took place between Mike Behe and Michael Rees in the last week on intelligent design. And it really has been the culmination of a number of shows where we've been looking at intelligent design in some detail. Thank you for everyone who's been in touch. And if you want to get in touch yourself, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll get some of your response to the event we held at Westminster Chapel in the week with Michael Behe, and I was hosting that. Thanks to everyone who turned out there. It was lovely to see over 500 people.
Thanks for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Hope you enjoyed it. And you can find links to our newsletter, the YouTube channel, ways to give, and the archive of past shows at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.